From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! As former counterterrorism czar Richard Clark's testimony continues to dominate headlines, Clark, who said that the war on Iraq was a diversion from the war on terror, we'll hear from two leading anti-war activists. We'll go to Kathy Kelly, who could well head to prison today.
In northern Wisconsin, these line crossings also occasion our crossing of lines inside of the U.S. prisons, but that helps us as peace teams to also give the voice to people who are in another kind of war zone, the prisons and jails of the United States.
And we'll hear from former British Member of Parliament Tony Benn, who crossed the Atlantic to march against war in New York.
And I do not myself see much difference between a stealth bomber and a suicide bomber in that both are killing innocent people for political purposes. And that's what we've got to eliminate. Otherwise, we're in trouble.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Republican attempts to discredit the administration's former counterterrorism chief, Richard Clark, are continuing a week after Clark first accused the Bush administration of failing to focus on the threat of al-Qaeda in the months leading up to September 11th. On Friday, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist called for the declassification of testimony Clark gave the House Senate Intelligence Committee 2 years ago. On the floor of the Senate, Frist accused Clark of telling, quote, two entirely different stories under oath. Frist later retreated from directly accusing Clark of perjury. He told reporters he personally had no knowledge that there were any discrepancies between Clark's two appearances. Democratic Senator Bob Graham, who is co-chair of the Joint Intelligence Inquiry, said Clark's comments were not inconsistent. Graham said Clark's entire testimony should be declassified in order to prevent the White House from selectively declassifying portions. Clark appeared on Meet the Press Sunday and encouraged the administration to declassify even more. He said, quote, the White House is selectively now finding my emails and selectively leaking them to the press. Let's take all of my emails and all the memos that I sent to the National Security Advisor and her deputy from January 20th to September 11th, and let's declassify all of it. Meanwhile, Condoleezza Rice went on 60 Minutes Sunday to again say she will not testify under oath before the 9/11 Commission, claiming there is a, quote, longstanding principle that sitting National Security Advisors do not testify before Congress. Rice also admitted President Bush pressed Clark on September 12th to find out whether Iraq was involved in the attacks. In his book Against All Enemies, Clark accused the Bush administration with being fixated on Iraq before and after September 11th. Just a week ago on the same program, Rice's deputy Steve Hadley all but accused Clark of lying about the September 12th meeting. This item from the Los Angeles Times. The Bush administration's pre-war claims that Saddam Hussein had built a fleet of trucks and railroad cars to produce anthrax and other deadly germs were based chiefly on information from a now-discredited Iraqi defector codenamed Curveball. This according to current and former intelligence officials. U.S. officials never had direct access to the defector and didn't even know his real name until after the war. Instead, his story was provided by German agents, and his file was so thick with detail that American officials thought it confirmed long-standing suspicions that the Iraqis had developed mobile germ factories to evade weapons inspections. Curveball's story has since crumbled under doubts raised by the Germans and the scrutiny of U.S. arms hunters, who've come to see his codename as particularly apt, given the problems that plagued much pre-war intelligence collection and analysis. United Nations weapons inspectors first hypothesized that such trucks might might exist, officials said. Then they asked former exile leader Ahmed Chalabi, a bitter enemy of Saddam Hussein, to help search for intelligence supporting their theory. Soon after, a young chemical engineer emerged in a German refugee camp and claimed he'd been hired out of Baghdad University to design and build mobile biowarfare laboratories for the Iraqi army. Only later, U.S. officials said, the CIA discovered the defector as the brother of one of Chalabi's top aides and began suspecting he might have been coached to provide false information. Partly as a result, some U.S. intelligence officials and congressional investigators fear the CIA inadvertently conjured up and then chased a phantom weapons system. David Kaye, who resigned in January as head of the CIA-led group created to find illicit weapons in Iraq, said of all the intelligence failures in Iraq, the case of Curveball is particularly troubling. As late as January, Vice President Dick Cheney continued to cite this evidence, causing the director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet, to phone him to say that it was questionable. The New York Times is reporting the United Nations is no longer expected to meet its goal of treating 6 million people with AIDS by next year. Currently, only about 300,000 people receive treatment. President Bush had vowed to spend $15 billion over 5 years to fight AIDS, but in his most recent budget, he requested only $200 million from Congress. This news from Iraq on Friday in Fallujah, up to 16 people died, including an ABC News cameraman who was shot by U.S. soldiers during gun battles. A U.S. Marine also died. Witnesses said the Iraqi cameraman Boran Mohammed was shot in the head. Reporters Without Borders called on the U.S. Army to, quote, open immediate investigation into this very serious incident. According to the group, the U.S. has now killed 7 journalists in the past year. A total of 23 media workers have died since the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Meanwhile, the U.S. has shut down an Iraqi Shiite newspaper because it claimed the paper was inciting violence against U.S. troops. Over the weekend, dozens of U.S. troops arrived at the paper's headquarters and padlocked the office door. The staff was threatened with arrest if they did not leave. One Iraqi journalist said, quote, I guess this is the Bush edition of democracy. The paper had accused the head of the U.S. occupation, Paul Bremer, of ruling the country and mistreating the Shiite population in a manner, quote, like Saddam. In other Iraq news, the country's most influential Shiite cleric, the Ayatollah Sistani, is considering issuing a fatwa declaring the scheduled U.S. transfer of power to Iraqis to be illegal if the interim constitution is not amended. Levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere have risen by a record amount in the past year, raising fears that global warming may be accelerating out of control. This, according to a report in the Independent of London. The data is based on measurements by U.S. government scientists. Scientists have found that the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has risen sharply in each of the past 3 years. Some scientists fear this shows that global warming is feeding itself with rising temperatures causing increases in carbon dioxide, which then helps drive the temperatures even higher. In Israel, the country's top prosecutor recommended on Sunday that Prime Minister Ariel Sharon be indicted on charges of taking bribes in return for political favors. In France, President Jacques Chirac partly suffered a major defeat at the polls in regional elections. According to the BBC, the socialists and their allies won 50% of the second-round voters, while Chirac's center-right party won about 40%. The results could cause French Prime Minister Jean-Pierre Raffarin to be sacked. At a memorial conference at the United Nations on the Rwandan genocide, the United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan said he could and should have done more to stop the killing that took at least 800,000 lives. Annan said, quote, the international community is guilty of sins of omission. At the time, the UN Security Council failed to send a small peacekeeping force to stop the ethnic cleansing. In Afghanistan, elections have been postponed from June until September yesterday because of security concerns and voter registration delays. In this country, even before President Bush signed a bill into law in November outlawing a type of late-term abortion, opponents made the unusual step of filing three federal lawsuits seeking to block it. The lawsuits will be heard today in a trio of courtrooms stretching from coast to coast as pro-choice activists challenge the first substantial limitation on abortion since the Supreme Court's landmark Roe v. Wade decision. The simultaneous litigation focuses on the ban on late-term abortions. National Abortion Federation, Planned Parenthood Federation of America, and a handful of doctors sued in San Francisco, New York, and Lincoln, Nebraska to overturn the law.
Will you harbor a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, a heretic, convict, or spy? Will you harbor a runaway child, a poet, a prophet, a king? Would you harbor an exile or a refugee, a person living with AIDS? Would you harbor a Tubman, a Garrett, a Truth, a fugitive, or a slave? Would you harbor a Haitian, Korean, or Czech, a lesbian, or a gay?
Would you harbor me, sweet honey in the rock, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Veteran anti-war activist and Nobel Peace Prize nominee Kathy Kelly could be headed to prison today. The founder of the peace group Voices in the Wilderness appears in federal court in Madison, Wisconsin, where she's facing a month prison sentence for refusing to pay a fine stemming from an anti-war protest last May. In that action, Kathy Kelly and 11 other activists entered the site of the Navy's Elf Trident transmitter site in the northern woods of Wisconsin. ELF stands for Extremely Low Frequency Waves. It's a military system used to trigger nuclear missiles and cruise missiles. Cruise missiles were the main weapon of choice among war planners as the Shock and Awe campaign against Iraq was developed. As Kathy Kelly faces the judge in Wisconsin today, she's also preparing to serve a three-month sentence next week for her nonviolent civil disobedience at the U.S. Army School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, last November. During that action, Kathy Kelly was hogtied by military police at the base after being arrested. She begins serving that sentence on April 6, where she'll join many people across the country who will be serving 3 to 6 month sentences for that protest. Kathy joins us on the phone now from Wisconsin. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk more specifically about the protest you're being sentenced for today? I don't think ELF is a household term.
Well, that's certainly true, and yet it's something that's been around for such a long time, and hundreds of activists have crossed the line there. The ELF facility is what's used in a first strike nuclear attack scenario. It's never been put to use for such a first-strike attack, and it would only be useful in terms of launching nuclear weapons if the U.S. decided that it wanted to attack another country, either preemptively or at any rate without us being attacked first, because it takes 15 minutes to blast the signal that the ELF transmitters would send through the core of the Earth's bedrock and then down to waiting submarines, which would then know to launch a nuclear missile. But if the United States were attacked first, a retaliation would happen much more swiftly. So in many ways, people have felt that the ELF technology might almost be irrelevant. But it turns out that they were using it during the Operation Shock and Awe campaign because 57 of the Navy's ships were outfitted with these ELF transmitters that were also useful in fast-tracking the cruise missiles. And, of course, the threatened launch of many hundreds of cruise missiles actually then did take place by, on the third day of the Shock and Awe campaign.
I know one of the communities involved in the ongoing ELF protests is the Anathoth community. Can you talk about the longtime witness at the ELF site?
Well, the Anathoth community recognized that this was one of the places of the sort of network for nuclear armament of the United States about 2 decades ago and decided to move up there and make as a dedicated witness for their growing community regular events at the Project ELF site, every celebration of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday, every Mother's Day, August 6th to 9th, Hiroshima and Nagasaki being commemorated of every year. Occasion gatherings of people who go up there sometimes with tents and always with very, very creative actions. And many people have gotten lengthy sentences. Jeff Lay served 2 years along with George Osterman for cutting down the poles that support the ELF line, electrical lines. And Bonnie Erfer has repeatedly engaged in line crossings. Michelle Nar-Ovid just was released from a one-month prison sentence. And we certainly see a connection between crossing the line at Project ELF, going into war zones in other countries that might be the recipients of United States Tomahawk cruise missiles, and also crossing the line at a place like Fort Benning where military combat training continues. Because what we all want to say is, look, $400 billion being spent every year on our bloated military budget is a useless way to try to protect people in the United States. It would be far better to just all start asking ourselves, why would people in other countries hate us so much that they'd like to see attacks land on U.S. people or U.S. allies? Well, I think if it's a quick discussion once you start to explore what happens after these cruise and Tomahawk missiles and all manner of other bombardment land on other people, or they suffer through our economic sanctions, or they're punished by our allies. And it's also a good idea for those of us who can to go toward another war zone that's often very shrouded. And I consider that to be the prisons and jails of the United States, where, you know, once upon a time in this country, we had a war on poverty. Now I think we have a war against the poor. And who goes inside those jails? Some of the people who've been most abysmally failed by U.S. education systems and U.S. social services. So it's not a bad idea to go in there and just listen and try to find out what's happening to people on the other side of those lines.
We're talking to Kathy Kelly, who faces prison today, about to be sentenced in Wisconsin. Kathy, a lot of people who oppose the war are dedicating this year to trying to work electorally against the president who invaded Iraq, against President Bush. Instead, you are facing 2 prison terms, will be in prison. Do you think that is the most effective way to express your opposition to the current policy?
Well, I do believe that it's one way. I don't like to, you know, organize in my own mind hierarchies of what's the best way, but it is a good way for those who can to proceed. It seems to me that it's very important that the Bush administration not get a mandate from U.S. people to continue more of the terrible setbacks that he's occasioned for people throughout the world and also here in the United States with regard to the lack of an energy plan and the setback in terms of economic realities. There are so many things that he has done that I think have been ruthless and indefensible. But I don't think it would be wise for us to think that all we need to do is switch over to the Democratic Party and things would be different. I don't see any presidential candidate except Dennis Kucinich who is willing to clearly articulate the need for an energy plan that involves us changing our lifestyles. And I think that that's crucial. It's unavoidable. If we're not willing to either start asking other countries, okay, what price do you want us to pay for your precious and irreplaceable resources, and either pay it or say we'll find another way to live without those resources, and also address the actual war that's going on against the biodiversity of the planet. These are the major, major issues, and I think other things come up as smokescreens that distract us from what really ought to preoccupy us. And that's so important when people consider the war on terror, because, again, no matter what's happening in the debates with Richard Clark, which is all very important and ought to go under intense scrutiny, it still begs the question, what is the root cause of terror? And if we don't start to address that, what kinds of terrible situations will Western leaders be bringing their populations into?
Kathy, it's interesting that you say none of the candidates except Denis Kucinich, because there was a major unity meeting on Thursday of all the Democratic candidates rallying around John Kerry, and Kucinich was the only one who was not there. You have spent much of the last year during the bombing of Iraq in Iraq. In the last week, Iraq is headlines again because of Richard Clark, the former counterterrorism chief in the White House, who says that the war in Iraq is was a diversion from, weakened the war on terror. What is your response to this key establishment figure who was there through Clinton's presidency and then through Bush's invasion of, in the lead up to the invasion of Iraq?
Well, I think he's shown a certain amount of courage in coming forth with what he must have presumed would bring him a great deal of heat and political slime campaigning. One can't help, having been in Iraq during the bombardment, which was so dreadful for people both during the bombardment and then in the terrible, terrible aftermath, one can't help but wish he would have spoken up sooner. What if he would have been able to make a difference? We were so close, I think, to being able to restrain Tony Blair and then possibly George Bush. And, you know, why did he go along with administration policies as long as he did? But I think, again, we're not being asked to examine maybe one of the more terrifying questions, which is, if the United States knew that Iraq didn't have weapons and went ahead and attacked Iraq, more or less went to war against Iraq because it knew it could, that Iraq couldn't fight back, isn't that fairly counterproductive? Aren't other countries all over the world going to be trying very hard, never mind al-Qaeda, to get these kinds of weapons so that they'll be protected, and the weapon proliferation is then going to create, I think, in the future, a terror that's inescapable for future generations.
Kathy Kelly, I want to thank you for being with us. Veteran peace activist, Nobel Peace Prize nominee Kathy Kelly will be sentenced today for a protest at the ELF facility in northern Wisconsin. And in just about a week, she will also be going to prison for her protest at the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we will turn to another longtime peace activist. He served in the parliament for more than half a century, and last week came to New York for about 24 hours simply to march in the protests against war here. Stay with us.
We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear. We as the young wish to say in this song, God bless great America. We give thanks to the old for achieving their goal. It is now up to us, and we know we must build up a trust. And we want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear. Power for the people. Power for the people. Power for the people. Power for the people. Hardening crimes is a part of the times, and it's rough for some people to live. Disease can move fast, but it don't have to last. It is now the nation's turn for all to be concerned. We can be free as steel.
Curtis Mayfield, Power to the People. Here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman. White House allies and Republicans investigating the September 11th attacks are continuing to press to hear open testimony from the National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, with one commissioner calling her refusal a political blunder of the first order. Rice said in a TV interview that she wants to meet with the families of the September 11th victims because she knows they're disappointed she cannot testify publicly. Rice said nothing would be better than to be able to testify, she told us to 60 Minutes Sunday night. She said, I would really like to do that, but there's an important principle involved here. It is a longstanding principle that sitting national security advisors do not testify before the Congress. At last week's 9/11 Commission hearings, Commissioner Richard Benveniste asked Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage to deliver to the Bush administration a 2002 Congressional Research Service report indicating that presidential advisors have testified before Congress in the past, including Clinton National Security Advisor Sandy Berger. At least two presidents have allowed their national security advisors to testify in public, but in both cases, the issue at hand involved political scandal. President Carter allowed Zbigniew Brzezinski to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee concerning allegations that Carter's brother, Billy, had tried to lobby the government on behalf of Libya. And President Clinton allowed Sandy Berger to appear in public before the House Governmental Affairs Committee on allegations of wrongdoing and campaign fundraising during the 1996 elections. White House lawyers have so far agreed only to allow Condoleezza Rice to meet with the commission in private and not under oath, arguing that to do otherwise would violate the executive privilege allowing presidents to avoid congressional questioning of their personal advisors. Senate Democrats have pounced on the issue of Rice's not testifying in public in a letter to Bush on Monday. Eight lawmakers, including New York Senators Charles Schumer and Hillary Clinton, argued sworn testimony before the commission is not the same as testifying before Congress. Well, the testimony of former counterterrorism chief Richard Clark continued to dominate the news headlines, with controversy swirling around the Bush administration's approach to terrorism. Clark's most volatile charge in his book Against All Enemies and in testimony before the commission is that President Bush ordered him to find out if Iraq was involved in the September 11th attack. Clark says that on September 12th, President Bush pulled him and several other aides into the White House Situation Room and told him, quote, go back over everything, see if Saddam did this, see if he's linked in any way. All week long, the White House has said it has no recollection that the September 12th meeting ever took place and that it had no record that President Bush was even in the Situation Room that day. But this weekend, they changed their story, saying the meeting did happen. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, in the center of the firestorm over her not testifying publicly and under oath, admitted it in an interview on 60 Minutes that Bush did order Clark, after all, to see if Iraq was involved in 9/11.
The president asked, I believe, though none of us recall the specific conversation, the president asked a perfectly logical question. We'd just been hit and hit hard. Did Iraq have anything to do with this? Were they complicit in it? This was a country with which we'd been to war a couple of times that was firing at our airplanes in the no-fly zone. It made perfectly good sense to ask about Iraq.
And that is National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice on 60 Minutes admitting the White House actively sought to link Iraq and 9/11. On NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday, Richard Clark again reiterated Iraq was not a major threat to the United States.
He himself said before 9/11, this was not an urgent issue for me. I didn't feel a sense of urgency. He acknowledged bin Laden was not the focus of him or his national security team. So before 9/11, not his focus. After 9/11, I say by going into Iraq, he has really hurt the war on terrorism. Now, because I say that, the administration doesn't want to talk on the merits of that. They don't want to talk about the effect on the war on terrorism of our invasion of Iraq. And so instead, they try to do character assassination of me.
Richard Clark talking about the president of the United States, George Bush. The U.S. went ahead with the invasion of Iraq on March 20th, 2003, over the loud and public objections of most of the world's nations and people. Last week, millions took to the streets and cities around the world to protest on the first anniversary of the invasion. Of the roughly 250 anti-war protests around the United States, New York's was the largest, with at least 100,000 people taking to the streets. Among those who spoke out at the rally was the former member of the British Parliament, Tony Benn. He walked more than 40 blocks at the age of 80 and actually flew into New York simply for the protest and then flew home. After the long march, Tony Benn ascended the stage.
Friends, if this demonstration was seen throughout the world, it would give more security to the people of the United States than every stealth bomber the Pentagon could buy. This is not a war against terrorism. It is the people of the world trying to gain control of the rulers of the world to eliminate violence from the politics of the world. In the last century, 50 million people died in Europe in the world wars. And at the end of the Second World War, the Charter of the United Nations began with a preamble. We, the peoples of the United Nations, it said, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has caused untold suffering to mankind. That was the pledge the old men of my generation gave to the children of today, and we must honor it, otherwise we face the possible extinction of the human race. When UNESCO was founded, they said, wars begin in the minds of men, and it is in the minds of men that the defenses of peace must be constructed. Let me put it plainly. We are like shipwrecked people in a lifeboat with one loaf of bread. And if you have one loaf of bread, there are only three ways to distribute it. You sell it so the rich get all the bread, you fight for it, or the strong get all the bread, or you ration it and share it so everybody gets bread. And that is what we are about. And I congratulate the peace movement in the United States for the brilliant leadership you have given to the world. And I hope that the lesson of Spain is learned by the voters of America and Britain.
Tony Benn, the former member of the British Parliament with the Labour Party, came to New York last weekend to address the anti-war protests in New York. He served in Parliament for more than 50 years. While most politicians in this country leave office to work for corporations or become corporate lobbyists, Tony Benn left government to become one of the harshest and most vocal critics of war. He is now the chair of the Stop the War Coalition in Britain. After the rally in New York, we sat down to talk about war, Iraq, and the Bush administration. I began by asking him why he was in New York protesting rather than being at the major protest in London.
I was in Cairo at a conference in December, and Ramsey Clark, who's an old mate of mine, said, would I like to come? So I said I would, and the invitation came, and I'm really glad to come because the American peace movement has got a difficult job. You're coping with the background of the Patriot Act and all the hostility and so on, and what you are doing is doing more for America's standing in the world than any number of weapons you might have. If this demonstration had been filmed around the world, people would have said, that's the real America, the America we know and love. So never underestimate the importance of the American peace movement.
Today there was also a major protest in London, but you chose to come here.
Yes. Well, I'm the president of the Stop the War Coalition, and they authorized me to come, and I passed on the greetings, which they would have wanted me to pass on, but about 100,000 in London. I heard a million in Rome. I don't know if it's true, but the Spaniards did even better. I think Europe is giving some sort of a lead now, which might be followed.
Now, most people who retire from public office in this country, who are senators or congress members, go on to a business career, to parlay that position they've had with political power into economic power. You've gone a different route.
Well, my father was a member of parliament, a radical socialist member of parliament. I have memories going back to the 30s. I met Mr. Gandhi in 1931. I remember seeing the fascist march in 1935. I campaigned in the 1935 general election as a 10-year-old putting leaflets through the door. I heard Hitler's broadcasts from Nuremberg. I was in London during the Blitz. I lost a brother, and many people did, in the war. And at the end of the war, when we had this huge labor landslide, we built the welfare state, we endorsed the United Nations. And I have 10 grandchildren now, and I worry about them and their future. And so for me, politics is not about a career at all. It's about trying to understand what's happening in the world and make a contribution in some way. So since I left Parliament, I've done 400 meetings in 120, 30 cities. I've done about 800 broadcasts. I've written a couple of books. And I'm just busier than I've ever been in my life. But I'm free of the pressures of elected office, where you're always worried about whether you'll get on. When you're 80, you don't bother about yourself. You're just trying to concentrate on the issue.
You met Gandhi. What is your memory? You were
I do remember him. Yes, I met him. I don't remember what he said. I was six. I sat on the floor, and he was sitting on the floor. And you see, the thing about Gandhi that impressed me was, like, he didn't, like most people, pat the child on the head and go and talk to your dad. He said, come and sit on the floor. And my brother and I sat next to him, and I don't know what he said, and what I said wouldn't have mattered. But he made a huge impression, and I was in the States, funnily enough, when he was assassinated. And I felt it very strongly. I think it was about, was it 47, 48, he was assassinated in India by, I think, a Hindu extremist. And Gandhi played a huge role. He, like Mandela, there are some people who in each generation speak for the human race, and Gandhi spoke for the human race. And you know, when he was in London, a journalist said to him, what do you think of civilization in Britain? Gandhi said, I think it would be a very good idea, you know, rather like, he made a big impact on me, non-violence.
As a member of parliament for decades, what do you think, where do you think you can wield the most effective power and engage and affect social change the most?
Well, the thing about being a member of parliament is this. You are a representative. It's the only job in the world where you have one employee and 60,000 employers. And when I was in my district, everyone employed me, the bus driver, the street sweeper, the home help, the cab driver, the policeman, they employed me. And my job was to represent them and to speak for them. And everything I learned from my constituents. 1,000 people came to see me in my last year with problems. And you'd no good in lecturing them, you just wanted to help them. And then you said to yourself, what have I learned from that? And that's where my politics came from. It didn't come from school. It's experience is the real thing, the real teacher. And it committed me. And during miners' strike in Britain 20 years ago, I had 299 public meetings for the miners in a year because I represented a mining district. And all the pits were closed when Thatcher launched a war against the National Union of Mine Workers. So that's where my ideas came from. And freedom now, not wanting anything, is so important politically. To yourself.
We're talking to Tony Benn, former member of parliament. Exactly how many years did you serve in
51.
Parliament?
51. 51 in all. I was elected at 25. And I tell you, the day I was elected, no one would ever forget, was the day that Harry Truman said that he might use an atomic bomb in the Korean War. And Mr. Attlee, the Labour Prime Minister, flew straight to Washington and stopped it. And that's the special relationship that means something. Well, I'll give you another example. In 1956, at the time of the Suez War, President Eisenhower stopped Eden from continuing the war. And when I was in the cabinet with Harold Wilson wouldn't send troops to Vietnam. I mean, if a special relationship means anything, it means friendship. You tell the truth to your friends, whether they want to hear it or not. And I think all these things have made a deep impression on me. I was in Cairo in December and was introduced at a meeting by an old man who said, last time I saw Tony Benn was in Trafalgar Square when we were campaigning against the Suez War. That was 50 years ago. And I do think that some historical perspective helps. All empires come and go. British Empire, I was born in, and it all disappeared. And I tell you, the only way you can get peace if you run an empire is to get out. I mean, our relations with the empire, the old empire, far better now we left than when we tried to run them. And maybe there are lessons for the United States on that. I don't know, possibly.
Well, what about that? This idea of, well, you certainly have seen the British Empire.
Yeah.
Do you see the U.S. as building empire right now?
Oh, it's the biggest empire the world has ever known. I mean, your defense budget is it greater than the 10 or 20 next most powerful countries in the world? 745 bases in 130 countries? I mean, it's the most powerful empire, but like all empires, if it falls, it falls partly because the opposition to it is so strong, but partly because in the imperial country, the people realize that it's money for the empire or money for their health or education. And in Britain, there's a very, very strong support for all the colonial leaders. And I've known so many terrorists, I have to admit this, whom I've met. Well, Gandhi wasn't a terrorist because he believed in nonviolence, but Nehru was in prison all the time. Kwame Nkrumah was in prison. I knew him very well. Kenneth Kaunda was in prison. Shady Jagan was in prison. Ben Bella, the Algerian leader, was arrested, kidnapped by the French and sent to the Bastille. I know them all. And the thing about these terrorists is that they ended up as head of state. And in Britain, they ended up having tea with the Queen, having been terrorists. So maybe you learn something also about the use of the word terrorism, because Osama bin Laden was a terrorist, armed by Bush's father, to get rid of the Russians from Afghanistan. And so I think a clarity of language is important. That's where Democracy Now! Is such an important, if I may say so, to your broadcasting outlet, because it allows people to hear different perspectives so they can think about it and make up their own mind. You're not trying to impose an explanation, but when people think about it, they may realize that they've been misled by the mainstream media and by political leaders.
Tony Benn, leader in the British Parliament for more than 50 years, speaking in New York last weekend after the protest. We continue with our conversation with him, and if you'd like to get a copy, you can go to our website at democracynow.org, or you can call 1-800-881-2359. Back with the conversation in a minute. Elvis Costello, Peace, Love, and Understanding, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, as we continue with our conversation with the chair of the Stop the War Coalition and former member of the British Parliament, Tony Benn.
You're here on a major day of protest, yes, not only in New York and the United States, but around the world. But what difference does protest make? We saw this a year ago, right before the U.S. and Britain invaded Iraq, and they went ahead and did it.
Well, I know, but you have to take a proper perspective. If you'd been interviewing me 30 years ago about apartheid, you could have said to me, now look, Tony, Mandela's in prison. The whites control the army and the police and the media. There are no trade unions. Be realistic. Apartheid will never end, but it did. How long did it take women to get the vote in the United States? They campaigned for years, as they did in Britain. They got the vote to organize trade unions. The environmental movement, when the environmental movement was first aired, people thought it was just these bearded weirdies who worried about the the climate or something. Now everybody has to pay tribute to it. So progress comes in different ways. But the one thing you can be sure about, all progress starts at the bottom and it reaches the top at the end. Leaders are the last people to get the message. Congress and Parliament. I used to say this to the House of Commons. They didn't like it very much. But when the House of Commons decides something, you know for certain the public decided it years ago in their own minds. And maybe we didn't stop the Iraq war, but Bush couldn't get Blair to go along with a war against Iran or Syria. I mean, that is the end of that episode. And so it was a tremendously significant thing. And look at Spain. I mean, if you wonder what the peace movement does, we now have a new Spanish government. And you know, votes are a bit more important than opinion polls because they tell you what's got to happen. They don't just indicate public opinion.
You say that Blair stopped at Syria and Iran. How do you know that?
Well, he couldn't get away with it. You see, what's the price that Blair has paid and maybe Bush too? Nobody believes what they're told anymore. And this theory people are apathetic, I don't accept. I think people are angry that no one listens to them and they don't believe what they're told. And anger and mistrust are not the same as apathy. It's a political movement growing up outside the established political system. And that movement has got to be reintegrated with the political system so the result reflects what people think. And I think that is the price the Prime Minister has paid. People don't believe him, not just on the war, but on anything. And can you imagine him coming along and saying that we now believe there are weapons of mass destruction in Iran? We've got to deal with them. It wouldn't wash anymore. So we have hope is very important. Hope is the fuel of progress. Fear is a prison we put ourselves into. And pessimism is a prison we put ourselves into. Hope is the fuel that makes people work.
Can you explain the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, to the American people?
Well, when he became leader of the Labour Party 10 years ago, he said, New Labour is a new political party. And I'm very, very glad he said that, because I'm not a member of New Labour. I'm a member of the Labour Party. Labour Party's never been a socialist party, but it's always had socialists in it, just as there are some Christians in the churches. Everybody knows an exact parallel. And the Labour Party is built on the working class movement, the trade union movement, with some socialists, with a commitment to progress and peace and justice. And Mrs. Thatcher was asked the other day what was her greatest achievement, and she said New Labour. Now that tells you all you need to know about New Labour.
Will Blair last?
I don't know. I think it's a great mistake to think of politics in terms of personalities. You know, you kill Saddam or capture him, what difference does that make? You kill Osama bin Laden, what difference does that make? It isn't about that, it's about movements. And what the peace movement is about is its strength comes in the fact that it's not asking you primarily to elect anyone. It's saying we've got to have a different understanding of the world. And that understanding then becomes the mainstream of opinion, which no political leader could ignore.
We're talking to Tony Benn in the Parliament of Britain for more than half a century, now head of the Stop the War Coalition. This coalition you have in Britain, how networked is it with other peace movements around the world?
Very closely networked. I mean, I get about 10 emails a day on my laptop at home telling me about the American peace movement, exactly what it's doing. Very few people in Britain generally know, but the Stop the War people know. And I think the biggest change technically that's occurred is not the stealth bomber or the Star Wars. It's the fact that people can communicate with each other now. And although it doesn't go to everybody, the organisers know it. You see, we had 2 million in London on February the 15th last year, simultaneously in, 60 countries there were demonstrations. Same today, 250 demonstrations in the United States today, 1,000 in London, and all over the world, people are coming together. And you see, the peace movement is linked to the anti-globalization movement, the World Social Forum, the environmental movement, student movement, pensioners movement. All these movements are converging, or as you say, networking, to build a body of opinion that you cannot disregard. I think last year, the New York Times said there are two superpowers left in the world, the United States and the World Peace Movement. And that was a very interesting recognition of a new reality, which perhaps people have been slow to pick up.
You've been observing what has happened to the president of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide,
taken out of help.
taken out of Haiti by the United States. He says he was kidnapped. He says it was a coup d'etat and put in the Central African Republic, and now a small group of citizens from the Caribbean and the United States, a Congress member from the United States, Maxine Waters, went and brought him back from exile to Jamaica, where he'll decide his next move. What is your observation about that?
Well, it's in a long line. I mean, Pinochet, supported by the CIA. Allende, I know Madame Allende, his widow, and just toppled. The Bay of Pigs was to get rid of Castro and attempt to assassinate him. The bombing of Libya to kill Gaddafi, but actually it killed one of his family, but not that. President now says that Arafat should be replaced. Well, if you look, Chavez is under threat. And I think that's what empires do. I know we did with an empire. We toppled people we didn't like. And all the Maharajas in India, Maharaja of Mysore, the Maharaja of Hyderabad, these great Indian rulers were only allowed to remain there so long as they did everything Queen Victoria told them to do. And I sometimes think that reproduction by American imperialism is almost identical. And, you know, there are a few lessons. We invaded Afghanistan in 1830. The Viceroy of India, the British representative there, said that the Shah of Iran was interfering, Shah of Persia was interfering. So we invaded, we occupied Kabul, and a tremendous triumph. 18 months later, the British troops were beaten, forced to retreat from Kabul, and 15,000 troops were killed. We bombed the Sudan 100 years exactly to the month before we occupied the Sudan, 100 years to the month before Clinton bombed it. And I looked up in the papers because I was interested. And the Prime Minister of the day said the Africans would have grounds to thank us for doing it. And we'd killed 11,000 Muslims that day. And I sat in Parliament with a young cavalry officer who took part in that operation, Winston Churchill. We liberated Iraq from the Ottoman Empire in 1920. 100,000 Iraqis were killed, and Winston Churchill said, authorized the use of mustard gas against the tribesmen. I mean, learn a bit of history if you want to avoid making the same mistakes.
What do you consider your greatest accomplishment or accomplishments?
Very simply, I think I have encouraged people. And on my gravestone, I'd be perfectly content if they said, Tony Benn, he encouraged us. I'd be perfectly satisfied with that. Because encouragement is what it's all about. I mean, people say easy to get despairing and despondent and pessimistic, but if somebody comes along and says, you're on the right line, carry on, try it this way, but you're on the right line, that's what makes people do it. And blaming people and naming people and making people feel small is part of the technique the power elite use to keep everyone else down, because if people are confident, they're very difficult to deal with.
What do you think are the most significant movements over your lifetime, the most effective ones?
The anti-colonial movement, unquestionably, the colonial liberation movement. And I worked with them my first 30 years in Parliament, almost entirely devoted. That's how I met all the people that I mentioned. And what we learned from that was so important. You see, Gandhi defeated the British, but reconciled with us. He defeated us and still retained good relations with us. It was a brilliant achievement, as is what Desmond Tutu is doing now, Truth and Reconciliation. And the other thing about the colonial liberation leaders, they all had friends in Britain all the time. So that's how I got to know them. And they would come and see us, and we would plan their strategy. And then, because they knew they had friends in Britain, they didn't hate Britain. They hated the policies that repressed them, but they knew they had friends. And I think that, and the peace movement, the campaign for nuclear disarmament, because, you know, the only power in the world strong enough to deal with the danger created by the splitting of the atom is the unity of the human race. That's the only, you can split the atom, and that means you've got to unite the human race if you're going to control it. If you don't, if you haven't split the atom and the human race, you're finished, like the dinosaurs.
You mentioned Kwame Nkrumah. Can you talk a little about the founding president of Ghana?
Well, I met him a couple of times. I met him just before his prime minister, and he had dinner with us. And he was so modest and so charming and asked our advice. What should we do? You know, I was very touched. I was only about 30, I guess. And then When he came back, I met him again and hosted a reception for him. And the guy was a great national leader. Another one was Chedi Jagan, who was married to an American, Janet. And he and I corresponded right up until he died. And he came to see me just after we had toppled the regime because they didn't like it. Chedi Jagan was so dangerous. And he was these were very significant people, but always denounced by using the same language that is used now. Be terrible careful about terrorism. It's the elimination of violence. And I do not myself see much difference between a stealth bomber and a suicide bomber in that both are killing innocent people for political purposes. And that's what we've got to eliminate. Otherwise, we're in trouble.
What do you think is the most effective form of resistance?
Well, everyone does it their own way. I mean, some people set fire to themselves. You know, that has happened. It happened in Czechoslovakia, and it happened in Buddhist monks. And what they do is they recognize that by dying, they educate people. The hunger strikers in Northern Ireland, Bobby Sands, was in the Mays prison. And do you know what he said was, before he died, he said, "Our revenge will be the laughter of our children." I'm quite moved by that phrase. He didn't want to kill people. He said, "When our children are laughing, that will be the only revenge I need." And it is the educators. See, all campaigns are mainly educational. If they're just about a coup d'etat to replace a dictator with another dictator, they've got no democratic legitimacy. Democracy now is the right slogan. You've got to replace with consent if you're going to hold the power you've won in order to do what you said you'd do. Otherwise, seized power, revolutions that seize power, could end up like Joe Stalin.
We're talking to the Honorable Tony Benn. In the Parliament for 51 years now, the leader of the Stop the War Coalition has come to the United States as part of the protest movement here, to be here for the world protests against the invasion of Iraq 1 year later. What about the BBC and the real showdown with the Blair government? Who won?
Well, the government won in the sense they appointed a High Court judge to do a report who blamed the BBC and acquitted the government, although David Kelly, the scientist, died and the inquiry was supposed to be into that. And the top of the BBC, top management, resigned. But you see, the problem for Blair is that people trust the BBC more than they trust him. So although he's traumatized the BBC, and the producers are frightened. When I did a broadcast the other day attacking Hutton on the BBC, they cut it out before they broadcast it. But at the same time, there is support for the BBC. I used to be a BBC producer. I'm an old BBC man myself. And the BBC worldwide is highly regarded and respected. And if it's thought to be an agent like the Voice of America or Radio Moscow, it would destroy its value. Truth will set us free, you know, and I do think the BBC has tried, even though in terms of its domestic political coverage, not particularly sympathetic to the left. But at the same time, it is independent of government and of commercial pressures.
Tony Benn, the former member of the British Parliament with the Labour Party, 51 years now, chair of the Stop the War Coalition in Britain, came to New York last week to join with more than 100,000 people in New York protesting the first anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can order it on our website at democracynow.org. You can also sign up there for our Daily Digest and see our latest coverage, the special coverage of Haiti as well as Iraq and Richard Clark's testimony. You can also call to order a copy, 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Looking forward to seeing people in Syracuse on April 5th, Le Moyne College for the Dan Berrigan Lecture, and on April 13th here in New York for the kickoff of the Exception to the Ruler's book and media tour at Community Church in New York City. And then we head out to California. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Fabio Caduce, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, John Hamilton, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Protect them and those who may live in fear.